Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. The United Nations says at least 44 people were killed, more than 130 wounded in the airstrike late Tuesday. They had a migrant detention camp outside the Libyan capital. VOA's Heather Murdoch visited the scene.
The main detention center where people were living was bombed out, as well as a garage. And you can see in the main hall the remnants of blood, some bodies, clothes, food. People were eating and fled.
And she says some of the migrants ended up at the center after an abortive attempt to reach Europe.
They're all travelers trying to go to Europe to claim refugee status. Most of them are arrested as they are rescued from the sea. As you know, the boats that refugees take across the Mediterranean Sea into Europe are often deadly and often go down. And so a lot of people have told me that their ship was going down. The Libyan Coast Guard rescued them and then brought them to this detention center where they cannot leave.
The African Union is calling for an immediate Libyan ceasefire and demanding that civilians, especially detained migrants, be protected. It also wants the airstrike investigated. Citing orders from President Trump, the Justice Department now says it will try to include a question about citizenship in the country's once-a-decade census. This comes after last week's 5-4 U.S. Supreme Court ruling that the reasoning the Trump administration offered for including the citizenship question, that the information was needed to protect minority voting rights, was contrived and did not meet the standard for a clear explanations or explanation of why it should be asked. Mr. Trump called the high court ruling totally ridiculous. The census is important because it determines how many seats in the House of Representatives each state is allotted and how $800 billion in federal aid is dispersed. More at voanews.com. This is VOA News. National Economic Council Director Larry Kudlow tells VOA that U.S. and Chinese top officials will resume trade talks in earnest this coming week. VOA's Steve Herman tells us why and what that means.
Well, I think what everybody's expecting that we'll go from a truce, which we have had since the Xi Jinping-Donald Trump meeting in Osaka last Friday, to an agreement, a peace treaty to end this trade war.
And the current truce is in the U.S.-China year-long trade war has met President Donald Trump is holding off imposing tariffs of up to 25% on an additional $300 billion worth of Chinese goods. Kudlow says Washington will not be lifting its existing tariffs on China during the upcoming talks. Escalating tensions between the United States and Iran are exposing potentially contrasting U.S. assessments of threat Tehran represents to Washington and its allies and interests in the region. The narratives coming from top officials at the White House, the Pentagon and the State Department portray an Iranian regime that is either weaker and more desperate or more brazen and emboldened. And now the extent to which one of those narratives may be more accurate could be crucial in determining what happens next with Tehran threatening to produce more low-enriched uranium and further violation of the 2015 nuclear deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Britain has summoned the Chinese ambassador after he said that relations between Beijing and London had been damaged by Britain's backing of pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong. More from VOA's Henry Ridgewell.
The Union Jack flag has been a prominent symbol amid the pro-democracy demonstrations in Hong Kong. An ironic display of defiance as the territory marked the 22nd anniversary of handover from British to Chinese rule Monday, this year overshadowed by violent protests. The demonstrations were triggered by an attempt to force through an extradition bill allowing Hong Kong suspects to be prosecuted in mainland China. Speaking Tuesday, Britain's Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt warned such a law would breach the handover agreement.
That's VOA's Henry Ridgewell reporting. U.S. President Trump is promising the show of a lifetime on the National Mall, but his plans for July 4th celebration continue to face protest and some criticism. Find more at voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News. We'll be right back.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, July 4th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. A Kenyan court has given long prison sentences to three men for their role in the 2015 Garissa University terror attack.
We'll sentence him to commission of a terrorist act on each of the counts 2 to 150, where he will serve life imprisonment.
That's Josh Francis and Ndayi of Kenya. Women's rights groups have been meeting in Nairobi discussing challenges to gender equality in Africa. Sudan protesters and the military resume talks, but with some conditions. Rwanda is celebrating Liberation Day today, Thursday. And Malawi civil society organization will resume protests today against the country's election commission chairperson.
Protests and the videos that were staged on Thursday and Friday are meant to put pressure on the chairperson of Malawi Electoral Commission, Dr. Jane Ansah, to resign.
Timothy Mtambo is the chair of the Human Rights Defenders Coalition of Malawi. South Sudan takes reinforcement measures against the spread of Ebola, and a new book about the life and beliefs of Guinea-Bissau's independence hero, Amical Cabral, has been released. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A Kenyan judge Wednesday sentenced three men to long prison terms for their role in the 2015 Garissa University terror attack, in which 148 people were killed. Rashid Charles Mbere Saro was handed life sentence, while his counterparts Mohamed Abikar and Hassan Eden Hassan were handed 41-year jail term each after being found guilty by the court. Judge Francis Ndayi said the three were members of the Somali-based terror group who planned and executed the attack.
We'll sentence him to commission of a terrorist act on each of the counts 2 to 150, where he will serve life imprisonment. In total, therefore, the first and second accused person will serve 41 years imprisonment each.
Each of the counts 2, each is set to 30 years imprisonment, and this will also be reduced by 4.5 years, and so they will serve for 25.5 years imprisonment. Now, these two sentences will run concurrently, meaning they'll serve 25.5 years imprisonment.
Of Judge Francis Ndayi of Kenya announcing the sentences of three terrorists who were found guilty for their role in the 2015 attack on Garissa University that killed 148 people. Women's rights organizations in Africa have been meeting in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, discussing the status and advancement of women's rights across Africa. During the three-day conference, representatives from across the Horn of Africa said gender representation in their respective countries has been a challenge due largely to the lack of political will to implement laws protecting women. Marie Otiambo reports from Nairobi.
Women representation in most African countries has been questioned severally as women champion to be nominated in high-level offices. Speaking during a three-day meeting in Nairobi that brought together women from across Africa, Musuba Kotosao, national coordinator at Think Young Women in Gambia, said that just like other African countries, it has been a challenge to implement gender equality law in Gambia.
We have a lot of legislative framework that exist as far as the protection of women's rights is concerned, but there are still a lot of issues in terms of effective implementation, monitoring, or even the will on the part of the state.
In most African countries, women have been on forefront to fight for the rights as most of these efforts fail to materialize. In Kenya, two-third gender rule in parliament representation has hit the rocks four times, as most of the members of parliament abscond duty whenever the bill is tabled. Esther Waweru, a legal advisor at Equality Now, based in Nairobi, said that most countries are taking long to approve the Rights in Maputo Protocol, entitled to the African Charter on Human and People's Rights on the Right of Women in Africa.
So we've been pushing for ratification as the SOA coalition. Right now we have 42 African countries that have ratified. We still have another 13 that are yet to ratify, and three of those have neither signed nor ratified. That's Botswana, Egypt and Morocco. Whatever rights are in the protocol, they now need to be translated into national laws and policies and administrative action.
However, some countries seem to be responding positively to the gender equality. Mek Delawit Tesfaye, Project Coordinator, Network of Ethiopian Women Association, said that since the appointment of the new prime minister, women representation in the government has been at 50%.
After the new appointment of the prime minister, the cabinet become 50-50 rule. And then the ministry, we have 20 ministry offices. The 10 are the women ministries. We hope this goes to the ground and then all the woredas and the kabales will occupied by the women officials.
According to the World Bank, 61% of women in sub-Saharan Africa have one of the highest labor force participation rates in the world. Africa women continue to face some grim facts, as girls are still much less likely than boys to benefit from secondary education. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
Protesters in Sudan, led by the Alliance for Freedom and Change, have resumed talks with the ruling Military Transitional Council, the TMC. This follows intervention by the African Union and Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. The two sides have disagreed for weeks over the makeup of a transitional government following the overthrow of longtime President Omar al-Bashir. But the protesters have set a number of conditions for the resumption of talks, including that they will not accept the permanent military presidency of the new transitional council. Farah Aga is the chair of the Blue Nile Forum, an alliance of 14 political parties and three civil society organizations. He says any agreement that will bring about stability in Sudan will be welcome as long as it is inclusive.
There are hanging issues which are not completed in the last round of the negotiations between TMC and FFC regarding the level of the transitional institutions, the Supreme Council and the executive body, which is the cabinet, and then the transitional parliament.
Dr. Aga, I hear the protesters are setting conditions for the talks to resume. One condition is that they want political detainees that were arrested from the protest movement to be released and an investigation held.
Yes, TMC declared that they release all the political detainees. This is one. And second, the condition of the TMC, the investigation committee from the national group and not the foreign group.
What do you know, Dr. Aga, because the African Union and Ethiopia have been trying to mediate. So did they put some pressure for these talks to resume?
The African Union and Ethiopia, they brought an initiative. This initiative, the TMC mentions their observations. The observations of the TMC is in the leadership of the Supreme Council. TMC says that TMC has to take the leadership of the Supreme Court permanently until the end of the transitional period. This is one. Second, also, TMC is talking about the inclusive solution that includes the all political parties and the all Sudanese components that participated in creating this revolution. But FFC does not agree that they want only to neglect and to eliminate the others from the participation in the transitional period.
So, Dr. Aga, how likely is it that anything good will come out of the new talks? Do you think the two sides will reach some agreement?
You know, any agreement that can bring the stability to the country, that based on the inclusive solution, give a chance for the different components of the Sudanese community and the different parties that participated in the creation of this revolution to be part of the process, of the political process. Without that, no stability can happen in the country.
Dr. Farah Aga is the chair of the Blue Nile Forum. He was speaking with me from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today's Thursday, July 4th. Daybreak Africa time is 14 and a half minutes past the hour. South Sudan's health ministry says it is reinforcing measures to prevent the spread of Ebola following confirmation of one case in the Democratic Republic of Congo, about 40 miles from the South Sudan border. Dimo Silva Aurelio reports from Juba.
Dr. Pinyi Nyimol, South Sudan Director General for Disease Control and Emergency Response Services, says this confirmed case indicates that the deadly Ebola virus is moving closer to the border of South Sudan.
We are more worried because it's coming nearer, because people are moving. So anybody, a contact, can cross to South Sudan and then he can fall disease. And so the only thing we can do is to enhance our surveillance and screening, and also to alert our healthcare workers about this, anybody coming. Especially they have to start with traveling history. They have to ask whether this person have been in DRC or not. If from DRC now, they have to take more precaution in handling the case.
Nimol says the case was registered in the area of Ariwara, which is a trading center located northeast of Ituri province, about 43 miles from the border of Yei River State. Ariwara is closer to the border with Uganda than it is to the border with South Sudan. The 40-year-old woman traveled some 500 kilometers from the area of Beni, north of Kivu province in the DRC, according to Congo officials. Nimol says it is the first ever confirmed case somewhat close to South Sudan DRC border since the outbreak in DR Congo's Kivu province, some 500 kilometers from South Sudan's border last August.
Upon receiving that information that there is a confirmed case in Ariwara, at the border of South Sudan, the Ministries of Health, in collaboration with the WHO, they are going to send 7 personnel to the Yei River State. And the aim of this is to go and strengthen surveillance and preparedness for Ebola.
To clarify, Ariwara is not on the South Sudan border. Nimol says for the last 6 months, South Sudan has been under high alert and increased its surveillance response at several border screening centers established between the DRC and Uganda.
We have points of entry doing screening at the high-risk states. We have Ebola treatment unit established, like in Jubaya, we have one here near the lab. And there is an ambulance ready for any case, and there are training staff. If there is a suspect at Juba International Hotspot, it can be collected to the center and then the specimen taken for investigation. The same with Numbuli and other points of entry.
South Sudan's Yei River State border with DR Congo has seen a significant number of people crossing the border on a daily basis. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
Rwanda is today, Thursday, celebrating the 25th anniversary of its liberation from 100 days of genocide perpetrated against the Tutsi ethnic group. July 1st was the country's Independence Day from colonial master Belgium, but it was never celebrated because the government says the leaders who represented the country in 1962 were serving their colonial masters and harvesting ethnicity and discrimination. Yuji Uwimana has details from Kigali.
Flags are raised, roads are repainted. The country is celebrating in a tribute to the former Rwanda Patriotic Army, the soldiers of the current ruling party who fought to overthrow former Rwandan president Juvenal Habyarimana's regime. July 4th marks the end of genocide commemorative events, which began on April 7th. President Kagame says their struggle took the country from ashes.
But 25 years have seen us go from scratch, almost nothing, not just a total devastation, to something we see today of a country that is continuing to rebuild. And this rebuilding is not infrastructure, fine, we can see it, but the rebuilding of social fabric, which was completely destroyed.
Rwanda does not celebrate the day it got independence from colonial master Belgium, which falls on July 1st. The government says the leaders who represented the Rwandans in 1962 serving their colonial masters and harvesting ethnicity and discrimination. Some Rwandans share the same view as the government. This is Dr. Bihira Canisius. When you see the way people were discriminated and oppressed based on their ethnicities, you could easily understand the reason of the poverty that many Rwandans were living in. But now anyone has the right to think of business and run it peacefully. Other Rwandans are joyful to be a part of what they call a very historical moment. 50-year-old Harerimana Hage was born and raised in Kigali. He says, based on the city's development, Rwanda's true liberation was achieved in 1994 when genocide was brought to an end. Us who have lived here for so long, seeing how the city grows and develops, tomorrow is a holy and a noble day. Youth could use it for reference and decide to keep protecting the heritage and also start their own heroic initiatives. President Paul Kagame, who was Commander-in-Chief of the Rwanda Patriotic Army, says their ambition arose from the sorrow of being denied a country.
So there was the war fighting, originating from the injustices and all kinds of stuff, maybe thousands, hundreds of thousands of people denied their rights to their country and under harsh political conditions and other conditions. So that is what produced the origins of the war, which we had to fight.
The Rwanda Patriotic Front, the ruling party's army, comprises senior officers of the Ugandan army who were living in Uganda as refugees. Their families were driven out of the country because of their ethnicity. However, Uganda, which played a role in bringing about today's liberation celebration, is today considered as enemy of Rwanda as relations keep on soaring. Eugene Wimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
In Malawi, civil society organizations operating under the umbrella Human Rights Defenders Coalition are resuming their protest today and tomorrow, Friday, to demand the resignation of Malawi Election Commission Chairperson Justice Jane Ansah. The group says Justice Ansah contributed to the irregularities that allegedly plagued the country's May 21st general elections. But Justice Ansah has said she will not step down. Instead, she has described the protest as a mob justice that should not be tolerated. Malawi's Constitutional Court is expected to rule soon on a petition brought by the Malawi Congress Party and the United Transformation Movement Party that the May 21st election was fraudulent. Timothy Untambo, chairperson of the Human Rights Defenders Coalition, says Justice Ansah and members of her commission betrayed the trust of Malawians to ensure a free and fair election.
The protests and the vigils that were scheduled on Thursday and Friday are meant to put pressure on the chairperson of Malawi Electoral Commission, Dr. Jane Ansah, to resign. This also includes the commissioners of Malawi Electoral Commission. The reason we are calling for their resignation is that we have lost trust in them. We, as a people, gave them the job to make sure that we have a free, fair, and credible election. But the May 21st elections were a shame on us as a people. They were mad with a lot of irregularities, which they must make also acknowledged. They even mentioned that there were 147 complaints, which no one knows how they were addressed. So we say we cannot call those elections credible. That's why we want the MEC chairperson and the commissioners to go, so that can pave way for investigations on what really happened in the whole process.
Why don't you just let the court decide?
We believe the right to go to court to seek legal redress is a right in our constitution, and the right to demonstrate is also a right in our constitution. So the people that are going to court are the parties, and actually they are contesting to say the results are not a correct representation of the reality. But we as citizens, we are holding the duty bearers accountable. The people that will get the responsibility to manage the results are the elections. We are dealing with ethical issues. We are not just dealing with legal issues as citizens. So as citizens, we are saying our constitution under Section 12 says those that govern, they govern on behalf of the people of Malawi. And the duty bearers actually are the authority they have is delegated from the citizens. So if they have betrayed our trust and the authority that we gave them, we say no, we cannot continue being represented by the same people that we think they have failed to stand up to the standards that we expected them to do.
Do you expect that Mr. Lazarus Chakwera to join you in Thursday and Friday's vigil?
You know, he's a citizen of the Republic of Malawi. In the previous demonstrations we had on the 20th, even the leader of UTM, Dr. Saulo Chilima, also joined. So as citizens, as civil society,
We are saying whoever is the Malawian has the right to join. So if Chakwera sees it fit for him to join, Chilima, any politicians, they're welcome to join. But this is a citizen-driven accountability. This is a civil society-driven accountability. It is not being driven by politicians. So everyone that comes is welcome, but this is not a political process.
Timothy Mtambo is the chair of the Human Rights Defenders Coalition of Malawi. You are speaking with me from the capital, Lilongwe. A new book about the life and beliefs of Guinea-Bissau's independence hero, Amical Cabral, has just been released from Ohio University Press. Amical Cabral, nationalist and pan-Africanist revolutionary, was written by Peter Mende. He spoke to Ricky Stryak about why Cabral's teachings were so progressive and how they still resonate today.
Cabral's ideas still resonate today. This is the guy that masterminded the independence of Guinea-Bissau and Cape Verde and was also very active in the liberation struggles that eventually ended Portuguese colonialism in the other colonies of Angola, Mozambique, and São Tomé and Príncipe. So he's a giant historical figure. So for that reason, I mean, he's still a source of inspiration for generations of Africans, especially my generation.
In addition to fighting colonialism and fighting for the liberation of these countries, he also had extremely progressive views on women's rights, on development. Do you talk about that in your book?
Yes, I do. I talk about the book. There's a chapter on, for example, he's quoted as the need to show solidarity with every just cause. So he was in solidarity with all these, solidarity with the people, the Vietnam situation, for example, the Palestinian situation, the struggle of African Americans for civil rights. You know, so he had very strong positions, progressive positions about these situations in the context of the Cold War. As far as women is concerned, he was way ahead of many African leaders.
I don't think just African. I think the global.
And I was going to say and leaders around the world. Yes, I mean because he's talking about quota for women. You know, in that. In the liberated areas, they had the basic units were the Tabanka, the village committees, and he insisted on the five elected members, two of them have to be women.
And what do you think the legacy of Cabral is in modern-day Guinea-Bissau?
Well, I think part of the problem in Guinea-Bissau is the fact that he has been consistently neglected. His ideas ironically resonate in other places.
Peter Mende is professor of history and Africana studies at Rhode Island College. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Rhode Island, USA. But that is it for this Thursday, July 4th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Colotti and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Greg Burns, I am James Botte in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.